This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, August 26th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Xiang Fan became a staff writer at The New Yorker in 2016. Since then, she has reported on the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, the Hong Kong protests, and China's experiences with everything from wine production to hospice care. Her work is often critical of the Chinese government, which has made her the target of harassment and threats from Chinese nationalists. In an essay titled Motherland, published in the magazine last fall, Xiang tells a more intimate story about her relationship with her mother and their struggles to adapt to life in the United States. Xiang emigrated to the U.S. a month before her 8th birthday, and she grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, which, she writes, was as blindingly white as the blizzards she encountered there for the first time. Her mother, who was trained as a doctor, found a series of jobs as a housekeeper and made sure that Xiang attended the best schools. In 2011, Xiang's mother was diagnosed with ALS, and since then, Xiang has overseen her care. Last year, as COVID-19 swept through New York, Xiang learned that her mother's health aides would be banned from the facility where she is confined to her bed. Xiang described her mother's plight on social media, and the response from people in China was shocking. I spoke to Xiang last September about her experience as a target for anti-American sentiment in China. Xiang, welcome. It's so great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was thinking this morning, we talked years ago about how you might one day write about your story and your mother's. You described it on Twitter this week as the most difficult story you've ever tackled. What convinced you to take it on now?
I think I didn't expect ever to really dig so deep into my past, even though the story itself is quite intimate and intensely personal. I have to admit that there's a piece of myself that still feels that it is buried shame, that there's a voice that is perhaps my mother's voice that tells me that I should not unbury what is already past and what my mother, I think, would consider quite an inglorious past. But when the pandemic hit and her nursing home was closed off to visitors, keeping her alive really took precedence over writing my everyday life. And after that, when the Chinese social media campaign hit my computer and various social media platforms, it was this twin tsunami of events that really made me consider how I got to where I am.
The response from China was just shocking. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. So on social media, immediately after I put out a plea to New York City officials, New York City health and hospitals, to allow the health aides who really keep my mother alive for them to be let back into the facility after the COVID lockdown, all of a sudden, I was inundated with death threats, rape threats, but those were pretty generic. I think the ones that were most sociologically interesting to me were, I want to taste your mother's ashes, or I want you to eat your mother's corpse. They were so graphic, and their message, it was so unmistakably designed to wound. And the metaphor that essentially China was my motherland and America was my father, and I had been betrayed by my father. My father is no longer willing to even keep me alive. That really made me think about the relationship between the individual unit of a family and the country at large.
Why the outpouring of loathing and threats on your life and on your mother's life?
I think I became this pawn caught between this intensifying war between the U.S. and China that is largely waged on media and social media. And my story really exists at the intersection of anti-American sentiments and proudly defensive nationalistic feelings about China. And the fact that I had covered the Hong Kong protests not too long ago and have written stories about China that was not purely congratulatory, I think that's upsetting and considered a betrayal to many Chinese living in China.
So let's talk about your mother. I was just blown away by the story of her life in China and then as a non-English-speaking immigrant to the U.S. You write in the piece that she was shaped by a brutal, unsentimental pragmatism. Tell us a little about her upbringing as the child of party cadres.
My mother has always taken great pride in being a third-generation Red. Her father and grandfather were communist members, and they were not at all part of the elite. They were very ordinary party members. My mother's father benefited greatly from his acceptance in the Communist Party. It was as a party member that he learned to read, and his life was transformed by party membership. He took at least four bullets for Mao's vision of communist China, and his allegiance to communist China was akin to religious devotion. And I think that was passed down to my mother, who never disavowed her love for the party. And even as this piece was going to press, and I told her roughly what was going to go into the piece, the only two things that she said to me was, and it's very difficult for her to communicate anything, she's completely paralyzed by ALS. The only two things that she said to me was, I love my motherland and I love the party. It was actually quite moving to me, her conviction, because I think as a second-generation immigrant, I've never had that kind of certainty about anything.
So it must have been incredibly painful for her to make this decision to emigrate, which she did to join your father in the United States. And how did you end up in Greenwich, one of the most exclusive white enclaves in the country?
It began with the generosity of a very good friend now of both my mom and me. He was a telephone man who had come to disconnect the phone in the apartment that my mother and I were soon to be evicted from.
And we should say, by the way, that the first crushing disappointment came when you first got to the country and found that your father had taken up with another woman and eventually left you and your mother alone.
Right. Yes. I mean, my fantasy of the movie-like reunion did not occur in the airport, and the family really disintegrated pretty quickly after that. So my mother essentially had no money, no language skills, no resources for obtaining a job. And it was at this critical juncture that she met the technician who had come to our door to disconnect our phone. And I think through the sheer force of her personality, the telephone man named Jim invited us to live with him with his family in West Haven. And it was through him that my mother learned that America was divided by zip codes and that wealthy zip codes had the best schools, and that there was this town right, you know, in the corner of this, you know, relatively small state that my mother pronounced as Greenwich, that was particularly wealthy. And my mother kind of trained her sights on getting me to the best school she possibly could, despite our destitution.
In the piece, you discuss a Chinese idea, which even translated is powerful, mutual reliance for life. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you absorbed that through your mother?
Right. Well, after my father left and I was an only child, I was a product of China's one-child policy. My mother and I, we were each other's only family members in this country. Again, the acute shame of our failure, I think, was apparent to both my mother and me. At the time, my mother realized that we only had each other. And of course, I was much more dependent on her than she could ever be on me. And this idea of xiang yi wei ming, xiang yi means each other, ming is life. The image that springs to mind is of a weed that branches off and these twin branches being intertwined with each other. And that was very much how I experienced it with my mother. We really clung to each other. There was no one else, possibly in China or America, who could understand the circumstances into which we were thrust.
And you describe sort of as a survival skill, trying to divide yourself into a Chinese self and an American one. How did that go?
I think as it was happening, I must have not been even fully aware of what I was doing. As with so many tactics when it comes to survival, you almost are forced to adapt coping mechanisms. And for me, I knew that in the elite private school that my mother had somehow gotten me into on a full scholarship, I could not survive there being my Chinese self. I mean, I was naive enough at first to not even understand the mockery and the teasing. But for me, I think the feeling that every single other person there was a stranger that either regarded me with scornful indifference or, you know, active contempt. I think I really did feel like I was going to war each day when I went to school. And of course, at home, I could not practice my new American habits with my mother. I mean, I could not be, you know, casual with her that the way that I saw my American classmates were with their parents. And my mother and I were never openly affectionate. So I had to then revert to this Chinese self that really died, I think, you know, or began dying as soon as my mom and I landed at JFK.
The strain of that must have been, you know, extraordinary. And I must say that you have a great deal of your mother in you. There's no question about that. And you must be a source of great pride for her, whether she expresses it or not. You know, really more than fulfilling her very high expectations for you. What does she think about your career in journalism?
I think she is satisfied. Not because she has been able to judge the merit of my work. I think she finds my articles usually too long, even though I've explained to her that it's a long-form magazine. One of my favorite responses, actually, you know, a response that I often encounter after, you know, she survives, you know, my like 6,000-word piece, which many of which had been translated into Chinese. I mean, her English is not good enough to read it in its original. And by the end, two things. She'll say, wow, I mean, is that what took you a month to write and report? that's a favorite one. And also, and I think this is relevant given our current trial and tribulation on Twitter, she when she couldn't sleep at night, she would ask me to read out to her all the criticisms I had received on Twitter. I mean, really, she said that she had no interest in the praise because I could learn nothing from the praise. So that gives you a sense of my mother.
Yeah, not exactly a helicopter parent. But she has been on a ventilator, you say, since 2014 in this nursing home in Harlem, and you moved so that you could be very close to her. What effect did her diagnosis have on your relationship? Suddenly there's a power shift there.
Right. I mean, it came at a particularly unfortunate time because I think she was diagnosed with ALS in 2011, and I was in my mid-20s. And it was a time at which I had become fully independent. I was really starting to enjoy her company because I knew that I could never change her, but that I could tease out a certain brand of sardonic humor, not as her daughter, but as an equal. And it was at this moment that she was struck with the most cruel diagnosis that I could imagine for my mother. It's a disease that moves progressively, but that never pauses in its theft of its victim's body. And I think it was particularly hard for her because she felt like as she was coming into her 60s, this was the time for her to finally start living her life without having to worry about, you know, where her daughter was going to attend school. And all of a sudden, I was the one who was coercing her into making these preparations for a disease about which she was in denial for the first few years. I mean, even the idea that she was going to lose the ability to breathe, I think that was a prospect that was so horrifying that we never really even talked about it before it happened. I remember, actually, I was in the office. I was a fact checker in 2014 when I got a call from my mother's health aide. And the aide said, "Your mother is turning blue. She doesn't seem to be able to catch her next breath." And I remember I did not think I could afford to take a cab from our office to Queens. So I remember those being some of the longest subway rides of my life. And I remember thinking, I'm going to walk in on my mother's corpse.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So then the pandemic hit. And of course, you know, given your mother's health condition, it posed just terrifying dangers to her. So you went on social media to describe her condition, and you managed to get the attention of Michael Katz, the president of New York City Health and Hospitals, and other public officials. So that was really successful. Your posts did get her two A's reinstated, but they also attracted these vitriolic comments from strangers in China, and also a rebuke from your own family. Tell us a little bit more about why that was.
Right. It was a difficult decision, but it was also a non-decision. There were no other options available to me. I had made all these, plan A, plan B, you know, contingency plans. And I knew that that was part of caretaking, but part of the life that my mother and I share is that we've never had any cushion to fall back on. We always felt, you know, when I was growing up, even, you know, when I became an adult, and certainly after I, you know, became her mother in a way, that we were treading on the edge of a cliff. We were just a move away from everything collapsing. And the pandemic was the last straw, as it were. you know, I had run out of any space between, you know, my feet and the edge of that and that cliff. And I knew that my mother might never forgive me for the betrayal of her privacy. But I don't think I could accept losing her without having made this most dire of gambles. And it certainly had repercussions. The most difficult, I think, for both my mother and me have been the responses from our relatives and, you know, from her siblings whom she loves and from classmates that she grew up with. Their you know, forsaking of her, on the one hand, I think is perhaps natural. She hadn't been in touch with these people for a long time precisely because she didn't want them to know her fall from grace. But also, it to me is heartbreaking because she had spent her life trying to hide her disgrace from these people, and her fall was so, you know, spectacularly egregious. And the fact that I had a hand, was perhaps instrumental in bringing it about, you know, makes me still feel kind of ambivalent about the choice that I made. Though I'm not sure, even now, I could think of anything else I might have otherwise done to preserve her AIDS.
It also must be incredibly difficult not to be able to be with her in her room. And I can sense some of this. My mother has advanced dementia, and I haven't been able to see her since the start of the pandemic. Things have begun to ease in New York. Have you been able to get inside her room?
Yes. So there are now visiting hours. They're quite limited. And many of the difficulties that my mother still face and that her aides still face, you know, persist, and some of them have, you know, only deepened. There doesn't seem at this point to be an end to the pandemic in sight, and to be locked up in that facility as my mother's aides are when they come for, you know, a shift that can sometimes be as long as 2 weeks. They feel as suffocated as my mother does in her you know, completely paralyzed body.
There has been a really positive outpouring to your piece, which must help to compensate for the death threats that you had been getting. And it sounds like on Twitter, it sounds like this is mostly from immigrants who have shared some of their experiences with you after reading your piece.
Yes, I think that has been absolutely the most gratifying part of writing the piece. The fact that so many immigrant children about my age, I mean, they're no longer children, but they're the children of immigrants like my mother have written me to say that they see aspects of their upbringing, of their parents, of the shape of their, you know, jagged family in my story. And quite a few have written to say that they had mothers who were housekeepers on the Upper East Side, on the Upper West Side, when they were growing up. And that also happens to be, you know, this completely dark period of their parents' past that is never discussed. And when I receive those letters, I think I feel as emotional as some of the readers have been when they've read my piece. And especially, I think, this relationship between the immigrant mother and immigrant daughter in particular. China was, and I think remains, a deeply patriarchal society. And women have been so accustomed to be second-class citizens. But I think the fierceness with which a Chinese mother can fight for her daughter and the utter devotion that the daughter feels toward the mother sometimes can really, you know, collide quite violently against each other. It's the idea of, you know, the parent wanting a life for her daughter that she couldn't have possibly lived, And the daughter, realizing that the gift she has been given, the greatest gift that she has been given, is not the kind of material wealth and prestige that the parent, certainly my mother, has wanted for me, but just the freedom to choose a life and to stand by those choices that she makes. I know that my mother will possibly, will likely go to her grave, never fully understanding the choices that I've made and the political stances that I take. But I also deeply appreciate that the gift she has given me is the liberty for me to make those decisions without necessarily her approval. And I think that's a gift that that I'll never be able to fully pay back.
Zhang, thank you so much for joining me and also for having the guts to write this piece.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very grateful that it found a home in The New Yorker.
Zhang Fan is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.